With Rebecca Roth, our special guest tonight, we're talking about her work, A Methodical Illusion. It's about 9/11. Many more questions for her. In our final hour, we'll open up the phone lines, and you can jump in with us here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Rebecca Roth with us. Rebecca, I was saying, my uncle, through marriage, was on one of the planes. He's gone. People can Google him, Douglas Gowell, G-O-W-E-L-L, if they want. But where is he and everybody else that happened to be on those other planes?
Well, you know what? What I did to discover this is I kind of dissected as I've been doing these phone calls, and I took them flight after flight after flight, what they were saying, what the planes were doing, and I discovered that that the people making those phone calls had been told about what was going to happen that day. And to cut to the chase, I'm sorry for your loss for your uncle, and I'm sure that he was more than likely an innocent passenger, much like the crew members, and they are all dead. They just didn't die the way the illusion was painted for us. Let me just put it to you that way. What I discovered, and truly, George, it made me physically ill when I discovered this. I took these phone calls and the details that were being made, and I realized that there was someone on board that was handling these people and telling them what to say. On the second flight out of Boston, Flight 175, United Airlines, there was a young gentleman that used the term, and he called his father at 8:52, and he said that a airline hostess had been stabbed. And now, I'm in my 60s. I started flying in the early 70s. And we have never been called airline hostess. That's a terminology that's used in Asia, maybe the Middle East, but it is not something we have been called. We've been
stewardess. The stewardess, you'd be called that.
Stewardess until 1968, and then we've been called flight attendant. So this guy was 32. His entire life, he's heard to us called stewardess or flight attendant. And so I thought, well, that's a really weird thing to say because that's not American terminology. And so then he did something else that was very strange. At exactly 9 o'clock, keep this in mind, this is now 3 minutes prior to impact in the South Tower, United Airlines 175.
That's the one that the uncle was on.
Okay. On that flight, he calls his father back for the second time, and he tells his dad he thinks the hijackers are going to fly their plane to Chicago and fly them into a building. Now, before 9/11, nobody in their right mind would have ever dreamed up that scenario, and it told me that someone had told him what the drill was to be. And this is what I think was happening. The handlers on board told the crew members and the passengers, your part, did you know that there were almost a dozen war games going on that morning?
Yes, that I knew.
So they were told, and I've had, I can't even tell you how many American United crew members have contacted me. And because we would fight to the death to keep you passengers safe, we have deduced that the handlers on board had to have explained to them they landed at this place remotely using this remote control as testing the system, and that it was part of the war game drill or drilling air traffic control or FAA or some kind of story like that. Each aircraft had two people removed from it to make the phone calls. And they were put in a hangar, in an office, and they were in different offices. That's why the people making the phone calls didn't know what the other ones were saying. Like the flight attendants on Flight 11 giving completely conflicting reports about a passenger being tended to by a doctor and a nurse or being tended to by no one. So you see that I started to see this. Now, there was another guy that called out, and this is really interesting. This guy was a Top Gun fighter pilot trained at Miramar, California. It's San Diego. 6'2", 225 pounds. He fought in the Gulf War 91. And at 9 o'clock, 3 minutes prior to impact, if you've ever flown into Manhattan, you know that New York is about 365 square miles. So 3 minutes before you're hitting the South Tower, you know you're in New York. right? And so he called his mom, and he told his mom they were hijacked. He didn't say much about the hijackers or anything else. Didn't look good, thought he wasn't going to make it. And then she said, well, where are you? And he said, well, I think we're over Ohio. Well, Ohio is an hour and 45 to an hour and 55 minutes from Boston. He's a pilot. He should know that. And when you look out the window and you see Manhattan, you know you're not in Ohio or Kansas. And so I thought, well, that's an oddball thing for him to say. And then he says the one thing that was aha, my aha moment for this flight, 175. He said 8 minutes after the passengers figured out they'd been hijacked, 8 minutes. Well, he says to his mom, a bunch of us passengers think we're going to go take over the cockpit. That's the scenario for Flight 93. Let's roll. And I knew right then and there that he'd been told or planned the scenario, because there's no way that that would be a coincidence that they would do that same thing that they eventually claimed they did on Flight 93.
Okay, now that flight, of course, went down near Shanksville.
That's correct.
Pennsylvania. If you're saying it did not, but something did, what was that?
Boy, it's hard to say. You know, there was the ditch that they showed, that divot in the ground, has been found on Google Earth maps from 96. So the local people, even the local coroner, said there was no bodies. And in any plane crash, and, you know, the listeners, I invite you to just do a Google image search on any kind of plane crash, 757 plane crash or just commercial plane crash, and the Google images, and you're going to see huge sections of fuselage, especially an aircraft that large as a 757, and because that's like an old 707, just missing a couple of the engines. Similar in size. It's a big aircraft. The tail is huge. And so there are parts of an aircraft crash that just don't disappear. That was the one thing I looked at that day and I said, that was not a plane crash.
Well, we've got the controversy about the plane that reportedly hit the Pentagon as well.
Exactly.
They can't find bodies or much of the plane. Now, there was something that looked like it could have been an engine, but that too remains controversial. So let's make an assumption, Rebecca, that these four planes were taken and landed somewhere within a region where Boston is, I guess. Again, you're saying they did what with the planes afterwards? I mean, where are they now? And then those passengers, or are you saying all the passengers aboard those planes were killed after the planes landed?
Yes. More than likely, here's another thing that people always ask me, because you'll remember a lot of people that flew a lot, like me, were like, wow, the loads were so light. There were, 30 people on one 757. That's nothing. That holds 180 passengers. And it was a, coast-to-coast flight. So a lot of people have said to me, how come there weren't very many people on board? Well, I think that this was such a methodically planned out illusion that I think that some reservations phone lines were hijacked, and so that they were limited how many people. If they had been full aircraft, there would have been over 800 people to handle. But since the loads were light, then it was easy for them to put them all in the back of a section, like out back of the aircraft, in one area where they could make them do whatever they wanted and keep an eye on everybody, make sure phone calls weren't made, blah, blah, blah. Because on Flight 11, nearly 100 people, I think it was 90-some people or something, with the entire crew members. There was 11 crew members and 86 passengers or something like that. And yet only those two flight attendants made a phone call, and they were on the phone for 27 minutes. So you got to ask yourself, why didn't anybody else make a phone call? Well, this is what we think, and I've gotten my head together with a bunch of airline people that actually knew the crew members, the cockpit crew and the flight attendants on those airlines, and knew them personally. And they're dead, too, as well. They really did exist. The flights did operate. There were people on board, and, yes, in fact, they were killed. They were just killed in a different manner than what they showed us on television. And so what we think is that each plane, and until you get to Flight 93, each aircraft had two people removed from it, put in offices upstairs in that hangar, and then they made their phone calls. Each one had two people making those phone calls.
And these people did not know what was going to happen to them afterwards.
No, they couldn't have, or the crew members would have fought back. I know that. And so I think that they were told by handlers that this is a drill, and they were removed those people off, those two people to make the phone calls. On Flight 93, they actually took 11 people off. There were 33 passengers or so. And I think there was 7 crew members total, with pilots and the flight attendants. And once those people were removed, we are under the belief that more than likely, you know, how predictive program and the Illuminati like to tell you what they're doing. Well, one of the things that everybody said that called out almost every phone call said they've sprayed pepper spray or mace in the cabin. So we believe that some type of gas, perhaps a hydrogen cyanide or some quick-acting gas, was in there, and they shut the door. And those airplanes are sealed tight. And that type of gas, some type of gas like that, would, before people could really react and open the door or anything, they would be affected by that.
Why go through, if this is correct? I'm getting emails from people who are saying, do you agree with her? I haven't said that. I haven't said that yet. I've got my own thoughts. But why would they go through, and then we're going to get into who they may be, but why would they go through this exercise of landing the planes, taking the passengers off, killing them, and then send other planes into the exact spots that these other planes might have gone? Why not just let these original planes crash into the Twin Towers, into the Pentagon, and the one that crashed in the field in Pennsylvania? Why not just let it happen like that?
Well, no, I think that that's a kind of a common question I actually get asked. And I think that...
They seem to duplicate themselves.
Yeah, well, this was a sure thing. They actually could handle this as a sure thing. And what hit the North Tower was more than likely some type of drone aircraft. Originally, now there's documentation all over the Internet from the police that got their first phone calls was a missile that was launched from the Woolworth building. It wasn't a plane at all. And the original people that first called in said it was a small plane or it was a missile launched from the Woolworth building. So we really don't know what hit that. And it could have been some military thing. Like
well,
that.
And we have our questions of, you know, why those buildings went down the way they did. Many people that I've interviewed believe it's controlled demolition.
Looked like it, didn't it?
Yeah, well, it sure did. You know, you've seen enough buildings go down.
So to answer your question, why would they go through this? One, they needed the precision, and they couldn't take the chance that the pilots might override that flight termination system and take control of the aircraft.
At what point, though, is this a speculative or something based on some fact? I mean, we really don't know that they were all pulled off the plane and killed, do we?
Well, I don't think they were killed off the plane. I think they were gassed in the cabin.
All of them?
All of them, except for the handlers that got off.
The handlers and the pilots.
Because all of the crew members, I mean, I have, you know, I have United and American Airlines pilots buying the book from the publisher in bulk, because they get them for about $11 a piece and handing them out. They are so convinced this is exactly what happened. And as I continue going through this, as we continue talking some more, I'm going to tell you some of the things. Remember I mentioned to you the Brady Bonds and the gold and all those things that I discovered?
Mm-hmm.
Well, those, the evidence for WorldCom, Global Crossing, and the Enron investigations were all being held in Building 7. That one fell down at 5:20 in the afternoon.
Well, I do have my questions on why that went down when it was really never hit by anything.
Exactly. And you saw that as a controlled demolition. I saw that, too, and I thought, wow, how did they get that thing wired to demo it? I remember seeing the demolitions on the air, you know, History Channel or something on television, and it looked just like that to me, and I really thought it was a demolition. I didn't think it just fell on its own, and then, of course, I didn't pay much attention to it. But after I looked into it, it definitely was.
Well, I will give you that there are huge inconsistencies with the 9/11 Commission's report and what we think happened. Huge discrepancies. Mm-hmm. And things happened, the Patriot Act, and very bizarre things have gone on since, and they haven't stopped.
So you're answering your own question. Why would they do this? Well, look at the wars we've had in the last 14 years. Look at what we're doing.
See, what I believe happened was that some people in government knew this was coming down and didn't do anything about it, that they had that ability to stop this, to stop them all. Mm-hmm. But they said, no, let it happen for the things we're seeing unfold today, and that they let it happen. They let these 19 crazed terrorists get on board. They you know, how they took over the planes, I don't know.
They're still alive, so you have to deal with that.
You know, I'll give you the whole thing's bizarre, but for me, what makes it stranger is the fact that, you know, you say the planes were taken and then the people were gassed and brought
down.
Well,
you know, when I first discovered this, George, it physically made me sick. I missed it myself by not 10 hours. It could have been me on one of those planes. And to learn what I learned, and I'm not even done telling you everything I learned. I mean, I took all the information that I uncovered over, you know, probably 3 years of investigating, 20 hours a day. I lived in this until I dissected it, methodically dissected their illusion. That's the title of my book, Methodical Illusion, and that's what I did. I methodically went through every word that was said on the phone calls, why the protocols for hijacking weren't followed by anyone, what I would have done as a flight attendant. And the amazing thing to me is, and truly, I have to tell you this, I wrote this book 2 years ago, and I know I've sent a copy to Tom, but I'm going to send a copy to you, and I hope you have time to read it.
Yeah,
because
I'd like to
it
see
is
it.
A great novel, and everybody wants to see it made into a movie because it's a page-turner, and it wraps in all of this stuff about 9/11, the Brady Bonds and the stolen gold and all of the put options and everything that was going on that day. And it does it in a novel form.
Do you come under fire from some people, though, that think that you're disrespecting those people who were on the plane?
Absolutely not. I never have. And what was, I think my biggest fear once I discovered this was the flight attendants and the pilots, the airline people were going to hate what I found but then I thought, well, it's not any worse than watching those people jump out of the towers or thinking that you're strapped in a seat and go into a building. It probably was a much more gentle death. It's a death is a death. And so, but no, just the opposite has happened to me. I have had the most incredible response from airlines, even especially United and American people, that have said, you have figured this out, this is exactly what happened, how they did it. And you see, because I haven't told you this part yet, there were two companies involved in the FAA headquarters that were able to manipulate, they were actually there for the war games, making things appear that were not real on radar for those fighter jets that were playing the war games and for the NORAD screen radar screen readers.
But what's the significance of that?
Well, they were able to make things appear and disappear. So once that flight termination system took over the transponder and the transponder turned off, the air traffic controllers couldn't see them, they had the ability to create fake flight plans and have those planes go anywhere they wanted to.
What's the bottom line? What did they want to accomplish after they did this?
Well, I think it was, what's considered a false flag. I mean, you have the Project for New American Century, PNAC it's referred to, and it's, you can Google search this on Wikipedia, explains it really well. There were a group of people that actually planned, and they said in this plan, the necessity to get the American people behind these seven wars coming in the Middle East. A new Pearl Harbor were the words they used in the Project for the New American Century. And you can look back now. Hindsight's always 20/20, isn't it, George?
Sometimes it is. Sometimes
yeah.
It is.
Yeah, and so when we look back, and I think what's happening, and instead of the people, I thought people would be angry at this what I discovered, and what I discovered, I mean, I have not had anybody try to even attempt to refute this, especially airline people. They're just on board. It's just, you figured this out. This is exactly what happened. And these are their coworkers, and especially because most of these people are coming from American and United. It was very difficult for me. I truly was physically ill. I couldn't write. I couldn't even think or eat for a while once I discovered what I did, because it was very tough. And I was so close to being there. So what I found are these companies that were able to manipulate the radar, and so we didn't see what we wanted. They showed us what they wanted on radar.
All right, we've got more to talk about with you, Rebecca, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Well, welcome back to Coast to Coast. All right, next hour we'll open up the phone lines and give you an opportunity to talk with Rebecca Roth about her thoughts and her theories. So we talk about her work, Methodical Illusion. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Rebecca Roth with us. Her website, of course, linked up at coasttocoastam.com, methodicalillusion.com. How's the book doing?
It's doing great. I released the book in the mid-November. By the end of January, it was the number one book on Amazon in historical fiction. And it has been ever since, and I'm sure it will be continuous. So after this session tonight, it's been pretty amazing.
Did you self-publish, or did you have a publisher?
I have a publisher, a very small boutique friend of mine who had a little publishing company, and I roped him into doing autographed books. So I have autographed books available, you know, for people that really like that. And I love it because what it does for me is it opens the door when they have questions and they read this and they want to see the FBI documents that I used. They want to know what's the novel and what's real. And it connects me with the reader. And I just love it. I love doing that. So we do, you know, international and domestic inside the United States autographed books off the website as well as on Amazon, and that's available at any bookstore. But yeah, it's just amazing. I really honestly thought 20 people maybe would read it at the
moment. Oh, this is a topic that's dear to a lot of people. Now, I'm getting lots of emails about you, Rebecca, and they're running about 60% agree with you, 40% don't. But those on either side, they're very passionate, I'll tell you that.
Well, yeah, I've ran into, there's a lot of internet trolls that love this subject, and some are pretty nasty, but in general, I mean, I just got a Facebook from someone that said to me they knew Betty Ong and had flown with her, and she would never have stayed on the airplane 20 minutes, and that she was an excellent flight attendant and followed all the rules. So, you know, that's the kind of support I get, and those are the people to me that are important, and, you know, that's who I dedicated myself to find the planes, the passengers, and the crew, because that was my world. That was my life. And I realized this, George, that those phone calls, they had to have been made. They had to have been made so we knew who to shoot, who to aim our guns at, who to unfurl our flags and attack, and who to support. What wars they, and the terminology that they used was the most obnoxious and craziest. I've flown for 30 years. I flew out of Amsterdam with, you know, probably 80 different ethnic groups in 65 different languages or more. And I would never say about someone, you or anyone else, he's of Middle Eastern descent. And those words right there were used by almost every phone caller in that same terminology.
Like it was scripted?
Very much so. Mm-hmm. And these are the things I found. That's how I realized that this was scripted. And it wasn't protocol, and it was crazy stuff to say. And I realized then that if we didn't know that the hijackers were Middle Eastern descent, we wouldn't be able to go to those wars now, would we?
Well, I got to tell you, it's weird because I don't think cell phones, and we're talking almost 14 years ago. We didn't have smartphones that we have today.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think cell phones work on planes up there 30,000 feet.
They absolutely did not.
I'm pretty sure they don't.
They still don't. I just recently flew in about 1,800 feet. I lost cell reception. As a matter of fact, a friend of mine's a private pilot, and he said he turned his phone on at about 5,000 feet, and his phone said forbidden. In English, it just said forbidden across the screen. It was like, well, that's creepy.
Well, wasn't there also a reported call from Barbara Olson to her husband?
Yes, on Flight 77, there were, again, two people that called, and it was one flight attendant, Renee May, who called her mom and dad, and Barbara Olson, who was married to the Solicitor General, Department of Justice, Ted Olson. And she was a CNN commentator, and she's the only person that reported their weapon was a box cutter.
Huh.
And so it's interesting, that story, that's kind of a side story that, I mean, it's really kind of fascinating, because Ted Olson first said she tried to call, she called in collect from a cell phone. Well, that's impossible. And then he said, no, she called from an airphone. Well, I've had people from American Airlines tell me that, of course, they knew better, because their 757s had had all of their onboard airphones decommissioned by January 31st, 2001. So we know she didn't call from an airphone. She had to have called from her cell phone on the ground. And so what I did is, and I teach the reader how to do this, I went and I found a website. It's called airplanemanager.com. We'll crash their site now, giving it to your audience. As I know, I always hear people's like, oh, my website crashed. But you can put in their flight, if you want to go on a trip and you want to go from Boston to L.A. and see how long it takes and that, you can go in there and adjust heavy jet or helicopter or light jet, mid jet, and put in, you would want to put in, of course, for these, they were considered heavy.
Let me ask you this, though, Rebecca. Why do they tell us to turn our phones off if they don't work?
That's a great question, and I've had so many people tell me they didn't do that. They kept their phone on, and they didn't have any reception still just recently. So there are some specially equipped aircraft now that you can use your smartphone, because it does like a through-the-internet type of service for the, you know, different. But during that 2001, I remember standing in a 757 back galley with a bunch of flight attendants. We all had different carriers, AT&T, Mobile, T-Mobile, different characters. Carriers throughout the country, because we all lived in different areas. And we would do you have any bars? Do you have any reception? The aircraft itself is somewhat of a Kip Faraday cage. Now, I know we're all talking about EMPs and that sort of thing, and so you understand what a Faraday cage is. Because of the wiring and the metal, the aluminum, it makes you not have very good reception. We were on the ground in a Midwest terminal, very large airport in the United States, and we didn't have, some of us had no bars. Some had one. Some had two.
Well, look, I'll give you the fact that everything involved in that tragedy that day was very strange. Uh-huh. Everything, including the reaction of President Bush when he was with the little kids in Florida to, you know, the anomalies of Building 7 going down when it really had some debris hit it, but not a plane, not enough to just bring it down. Buildings like that just don't collapse and fall. That was weird. I think the person who was leasing it, Larry Silverstein, was overheard saying, let's pull it, or we pulled it. To me, that sounds like you took it down. Uh-huh. The thing was, now, if there was controlled demolition, and I've talked to a lot of experts about it, Richard Gage, Dr. Judy Wood, if it was controlled demolition, they would have had to have put things in that building weeks before this happened. Don't you agree?
Yeah, I'm sure of that. As a matter of fact, you know, I kind of did, as I dug through this, my main thing was the airplanes and how they did that. But I still got into that part of it, too. And I'm pretty sure they used multiple methods for the towers especially. And it would have taken some time, but I know that bomb-sniffing dogs were removed a week or two before. I just can't remember exactly when. There was a power down the weekend before, so there wasn't electrical power in parts of that building, the towers, the twin towers. And so there was a lot of really suspicious things going on, and a lot of interesting people connected to the security at that building.
So what you're concluding, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I will, that there's a rogue element of government, and that they are totally out of control.
That would be correct. I think that we may not be the only nation involved in this rogue business. And in my novel, I don't know if you remember the days, I believe it was in the late 80s maybe, there was a journalist, an investigative journalist by the name of Danny Casolaro. Danny Casolaro was on the trail of the octopus. And he was following, and I found all these people too, the Iran-Contra, drugs for arms, the Pan Am 103, heroin, and even back to the Kennedy assassination, and everyone that I've found connected to 9/11 somehow connects back to one or all of those events as well. The octopus, I refer to it in the book, is like the shadow government. The company that I was telling you was in the FAA headquarters for 2 years manipulating radar. MITRE, it's called MITRE, and it is basically the shadow government. They run everything from the IRS to now our health care and Obamacare and radar and almost everything else in between. They are, you know, when I was a kid, I'm old enough to remember when Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember hearing this military-industrial complex took him out, assassinated him, and I never did figure out who that was until I did this research, and it's very much so the same people involved. And they do have a plan for us, and I actually stumbled across that too. And I know that some of the commercials that I'm listening to as we're taking breaks and stuff talk about being prepared, and that's one of the things I always like to kind of end my conversation with people is how important it is to be prepared, because I stumbled across an article that was then within 8 hours scrubbed from the internet, and it basically was claiming that we would be attacked, another 9/11 style attack. It will be blamed on someone else this time, probably Syria and Iran, and that it will be a 5 or 6 multiple city attack going on for 9 days.
But you don't deny that there are countries and peoples who hate us.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've actually vacationed in Iran, and I know a lot of Americans think that Iranians hate us.
No, that's not true. Most Iranians love us.
I know.
It's the government there. The government wants us out.
Exactly. Well, you know what? It's interesting because I always get a kind of a chuckle out of the misconception of Muslim and Christian and that relationship, because I was invited to go back to Iran for Christmas by Shiite Muslim individuals that always go to the Catholic pageantries at Christmas time, and they wanted to share that with me. I just loved that story. I mean, I just did, I have Iranian Jewish friends, lots of them. The coexisting that is so, it's amazing, that goes on in all the countries. And I traveled and went to vacations all over the world in really unique places. So I have lots of background in people, and I love them, and they're all the same. We all want to live in peace, and our governments want to kill each other. It's just awful.
Well, but, you know, you had, like, the former leader, Ahmadinejad, the mullahs out there, you know, saying, you know, extinguish Israel and, you know, the dog of the universe and all that stuff, and I'm paraphrasing that. I mean, there's a lot of hate out there by those who are leading these countries.
Well, you know, what struck me when I was started to do this 9/11 research was the fact that these terrorists were, 10 of them, still alive, which means they absolutely weren't a part of what we thought we saw that day, those crashes, because there's some off every aircraft that are actually still alive. And the fact that it's okay for us as a nation and our FBI and our government officials to claim that these guys and these poor pilots that are still flying around, it's okay for us to claim that 19 Arabs did this when they in fact didn't, and then we can go bomb all the other countries that weren't even involved in it over this, and we're doing this all on the illusion that 9/11 was. And it's very sad to see that that's what has come out of this. And we have literally killed millions of people on an illusion. And it's to keep the military-industrial complex alive. And that is going to continue unless we can stand up. And one of the things that I really am enjoying in doing interviews is to open up the doors so people can understand that there are rogue elements inside and outside of our government that can do things without any government responsibility.
Well, there's no doubt about that.
There's no doubt
about that. We've seen what they tried to do with Fidel Castro in Cuba and the false weapons of mass destruction with Iraq, the tragedy in Libya. Look, Gaddafi wasn't a Boy Scout. He was a terrorist. There was no question about that. But in his later life, he was temporary. He gave up his nuke program and everything else, and now that's a disaster. We seem to meddle with a drastic foreign policy. I mean, drastic foreign
and
policy.
And it's becoming more...
Include Vietnam in there. I mean, there got a lot of friends who were in Vietnam. I was not. I was still in college then. But, you know, these you know, folks went there to fight. And as soon as we left, everything fell apart because, once again, we screwed up everything we touched.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's so true. I kind of... in that era myself and lost a lot of guys that I was in high school with over there for nothing.
Somehow between World War II, where we were brilliant, and what happened afterwards with Vietnam and everything else, everything fell apart.
Yes, we've gone downhill ever since Vietnam, I think, in our foreign policy. And, you know, when you're traveling around as a person, and you're eating with these people, and they're, you know, you're sharing their hospitality. It's just so amazing to see what the governments do and say about each other and to each other, and it's not a good thing. And people, I would love to give all the experience that I have from traveling and meeting all the wonderful people I have over the entire world, and give that to everyone so they could understand that we all want to live in peace and in love and harmony. Everyone, humans, that's the humanness of us. That's what we strive for. And unfortunately, what I saw is this plan, and I built it into the novel too, because I basically let the novel put it out there that it's the same planners from the event of 9/11. It was very much a false flag. It was very manipulated, and I methodically took it down one by one and found every player in there that did it, that managed to work through this, and then the cover-up. I even found two women involved, not man Arab hijackers. I found two women perpetrators or handlers in this, and an FBI document.
Well, we're going to open up the phone lines next hour, Rebecca. We're going to give everybody an opportunity to chat with you, question you as well. You're going to get a lot of people who agree with you. You're going to get a lot of people who don't. And we'll just make sure that we keep it as civil as we can and keep the dialogue going.
Thanks.
I did get a couple emails. I don't want to kid you, you know, from people saying, how could you come up with this?
Well, they'll have to read the book because it's all explained in the book.
You know, people, myself included, we really don't want to think that there are factions within countries, specifically ours, that could do things like this.
Well, my world fell apart when I discovered it, so yes, I agree with you.
And it all goes back to, I think, the Kennedy assassination. You know, after 1963... they figured that they can get away with anything they wanted. And they did. You know, let's plan the Gulf of Tonkin situation. Let's get America involved in Vietnam. We need something to get the Americans just all upset. So they create that we were attacked.
Exactly.
And in we go, and we saw that disaster. So, you know, on and on and on, the situation again with Saddam Hussein, who was not a Boy Scout, but he had Iraq under control. He had fought with Iran for 8 years. We supplied him with as much as we could to keep that war going. And then, you know, he made a tactical mistake when he wanted to go in and, you know, he got ticked off over Kuwait's slant drilling. And he specifically asked our administration, I'm going to stop this. Do you mind? And we merely said, it's an Arab thing. You do what you're going to do. And we went in and got him. We set him up.
It's true. And we've do that a lot.
And look what's happened now. So we'll come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take a full hour of phone calls with you, with Rebecca Roth, author of Methodical Illusion. You've heard what we've been talking about. What do you think? And she'll be around for your questions as well. If you need to email us, that's George at coasttocoastam.com.